Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this fantastic conversation with Texas Slim on processing plant fires, the squeeze on animal protein, people eating bugs, the new level of poverty we're creating right now with hyperinflation, and ultimately how we're going through a major global food and industrial shift, and what that means for you, I want to share a few brief words about our awesome sponsor. Protect your Bitcoins from disaster. CipherSafe offers a full line of stainless steel products to help you protect your Bitcoin from various modes of failure. CipherSafe creates metal BIP39, SLIP39 Bitcoin seed word storage devices that back up your Bitcoin wallet and protect them from physical disaster. CipherSafe also manufactures the Bitcoin recovery tag to permanently record critical information about your hardware wallet. When you've decided to be your own bank and hold your Bitcoin yourself, it's time to create a physical backup to protect those keys and your Bitcoin. For more information, go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix for this epic rip with great friend of the show, my man, Texas Slim.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Texas Slim's proud Texas heritage runs seven generations deep. Slim grew up under the same roof as his grandpa Frank. Grandpa Frank was a tall and quiet man who knew how to work the land and harvest his hard work to benefit those around him. Grandpa Frank taught Slim to be patient, respectful, and look for the well-being of others. Grandpa Frank's table was always overflowing with family, friends, and food. Their meat was locally sourced and food grown on their land. It was a time that changed quite quickly as Slim grew into his teenage years, and Slim saw his small West Texas town of Canyon begin to shrivel up with the weight of large corporations, big cities, and a corrupt food supply. Through the twists and turns of his life, he's fondly thought back on the days he shared with his Grandpa Frank. Grandpa Frank's teachings, stories of days gone by, and the way Grandpa Frank sought to enrich the lives of others has always guided Texas Slim. It is because of his Grandpa Frank that Slim has the motivation to encourage you to look into your food supply and enhance your food intelligence with the Beef Initiative. Texas Slim is the author of The Harvest of Deception, The Source of the Seed, High Value Lifestyles, Political Beef Deception, We Are Overfed and Undernourished. He's the founder of the Beef Initiative and Food Intelligence, the host of Texas Slim's Vision, and he's a badass by default. Slim was on episode 82 on The Harvest of Deception, False Commodities, and the One World Food Group, and more recently, episode 95 on the Medical, Pharmaceutical, Agricultural Complex, Food Intelligence, and the Harvest of Deception, Part 2. Slim, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Man, I'm doing good, Cedric. It's always good to see you. I always enjoy these conversations. They seem like they go somewhere. So, you know, much respect on how you do your show, everything, how you approach, you execute the delivery of content very well. So I wanted to give you props for that. But we've been good, man. I've been really busy and you've seen it kind of from a distance, but getting ready to head off to Colorado in the morning. So here we go. And it's been a long journey ever since we've talked last.
Yeah, it's great to catch up, my friend. It seems like it's been a decade since we talked. and it's been, 7 months in Bitcoin years. That's, 2 years already. Wow. But, it just time flies and a lot's happening. I want to get into what you've been up to, specifically with the Beef Initiative, this conference that's happening this weekend. This show won't go out by then, but and some of the travels you've been up to.
Yeah, I mean, ever since we talked, you said 7 months. I guess I'd been bad, you know, early December, maybe, or late December, early January. I can't remember exactly when it was. But at that time, you know, we were, you know, dipping our toe into doing beef for Bitcoin. You know, we tested our technology stack, our partnerships that we had out there. And we kind of innovated really fast because, you know, we had a rancher, Cole Bolton of KNC Cattle, that was said, let's do this. Let's do it together. Let's really collaborate. And so we looked at everything really hard. And all of a sudden, you know, when we kind of pulled a small trigger, you know, around the Central Texas area and the Bitcoin community around there, you know, I went down there several times and saying, hey, we've got a local rancher. This is what, you know, the ethos is about with the beef initiative. Let's all test this out together. So people started going out to Cole's ranch. They started meeting him, started shaking hands. We did some Bitcoin meetups there in Austin, and we just had a lot of collaboration with Marty and Parker and just the whole group down there, Kyle, just everybody that's down there in Austin. And all of a sudden everybody was paying attention, and we were selling beef with Bitcoin, and people were going, wow, man, really? And they were, you know, because we have it in the Bitcoin space, you know, you have the carnivore, you have the steaks, you have the beef, but all of a sudden people were talking differently. And finally, all that research I've been doing for the last 2 years with food intelligence was starting to pay off. And so we've been collaborating, and, you know, we had the conference last November. I said, I'm going to do 4 conferences this year. Never done a conference in my life. I don't know anything about them. I never really attended them unless it was maybe Lollapalooza in the 90s. I went to concerts, but I'd never been a conference guy. But I knew that what we were doing in the Beef Initiative required kind of, you know, face-to-face communications and kind of dialogues that you can orchestrate through a conference. You kind of do a package deal, and you know the people that are coming are going to be very intentional. They're picking up on something that they want to learn, and they want to be a part of it. And I said, we're going to do 4 conferences. So we did Kerrville, and it was a really big success. And I had a lot of people saying, you can't do that. You can't pull this off. And I was like, bullshit. You know, we're going to do this because people want to be a part of this. And so we're not going to hold anybody back. We want everybody to come into the Beef Initiative. You know, it's open source, you know, just like Bitcoin. And so I said, this is going to be good for the Beef Initiative. So we all moved forward really hard. And everybody doesn't really realize that the Beef Initiative right now is just volunteers. We have a core group of volunteers that does this. Nobody gets paid anything. It's value for value. And, you know, we exchange sats and everybody comes in for the right reasons. And we know that. And so it's such a good shift into this new way of thinking. And so as we move forward, we're having more and more successes because I follow the Bitcoin ethos as much as I can with the business model of the Beef Initiative. You know, we are a corporation, but we're not, you know, we're not making revenue. We're bringing in sats that goes to a scholarship program. So with that, we're having some success and people are starting to listen. You know, we haven't done any marketing advertising. I just hammer on the podcast when I can. You know, we've got a small media company now just released today. I think I sent you that video. And, you know, that's going to be hour long or close to hour long audio docu-series of everything that I've been doing the last 3 years and up to now, really. And we're going to kind of reverse engineer it where we can put a lot of information together at once and people can kind of, you know, it's sound engineering is going on, production is going on, you know, professional editing. So I think a lot of people are going to grab a hold of it because it funnels down into what we're doing and it funnels into basically, and it creates a lot of awareness of what's going on in the food industry from a global standpoint and across the United States. And, you know, part of what I just accomplished was like a 30-40 day trip across a lot of the United States, especially Texas, all the way out to the Carolinas through Tennessee, of course. And I did Alabama, I did a little bit of Georgia, you know, in touch points around 13 states. And why I did that, nobody could understand, but I wanted to go see some Bitcoin meetups. I wanted to meet some people. I wanted to start building some nodes of communication. And I wanted everybody to see me face to face. It wasn't about, hey, you know, this is going to be a big fanfare or anything like that. I just wanted to go see the country. I wanted to drive some back roads and I wanted to see what our world is right now And what I saw was pretty fascinating, a lot of good and a lot of bad. And so, you know, I met all the Bitcoiners up there at Nashville, met with Matt and Rod and Mills, you know, the founders of Bitcoin Park. So we established a really good relationship, and we're going to have a headquarters in Nashville at Bitcoin Park with the Nash Bitcoiners. It's going to be the Tennessee Beef Initiative there. And so I had a lot of touch points that I wanted to go out and meet some people. And so we can get the Beef Initiative starting to spread out like a node should spread out. So right now we have Austin, Luling area. We have the Panhandle of Texas. We have Colorado. We have Nashville now. And I've got about five people talking to me in different states, and they're going to start doing exactly and start modeling what we did in Texas. And they're going to start trying to do it in their state, their region, their locality, their counties, whatever it is that they see the opportunity. And we're kind of have a protocol now on how the Beef Niche can move forward, and we can move it across the United States with everybody that's involved in the Bitcoin community. And we're going to leverage the Bitcoin meetups, and, you know, everything that we're doing is hyper-localization. So that's what we've been doing. The Kerrville was a great success. We're going into Colorado. What we're doing with Colorado is we're supporting Jason Rick of Rick Ranches. He came into the Beef Initiative probably last year around October or November. He was one of the first three that came into the Beef Initiative. And I contacted him back whenever I had this idea. And I said, let's have a conference out at your ranch. And he was like, okay. And I said, well, no, let's think about this. You're a rancher that needs a voice. You don't have a voice in your local community, and you don't have a voice on the internet. You don't have a digital brand, and it's so hard for you to have that digital brand because of the censorship, and they have to use Facebook. They're so censored, selling beef online is so difficult, and people don't realize that. So I said, we need to give you another pillar of strength here. Let's have a conference at your land. Let's get people out there so they can come visit and see what you do every day. And let's do it on this level. It's not about numbers. It's about quality. And so we've designed the conference in Colorado just as that is in Crawford, Colorado. It's kind of a hard place to get to. So everybody coming to Crawford, Colorado, man, they're intentional and they want to know more. And what we're doing in Crawford, and this is going to be a staple moving forward in the Beef Initiative, we're having mining panels. We're going to have homeschooling and home birthing panels. We're going to have security at Matt O'Dell's coming out. He's going to do a workshop. We're going to have custodialship. We have some partnerships with Foundation and IBEX. We have a partnership with OSHI, of course. And so we're going to show everybody, this type of, everybody's kind of yearning to know more about homesteading, regenerative farming and ranching, market access to pure animal protein, and just food. How do you onboard a rancher? So we're just going to go through and really reflect on how we've had the accomplishments and how we're going to move forward. And after Colorado, I met up with Will Harris of White Oak Pastures, and he's out there in Bluffton, Georgia. And a lot of people who know who Will is, he's had a lot of success with the regenerative model. For people that don't know what White Oak Pastures is that he went out there and 25 years ago, he went strictly into regenerative farming and ranching. So right now what he does, he was the first person in the United States to sell grass-fed beef to Whole Foods before old Bezos took him over. And so he has a protocol. He has everything that the Beef Initiative stands for. And I asked him if we could have a conference, and he said, yeah. And he goes, why do you want to have this? And he goes, what do you stand for? And I said, well, what my why is that I'm going to save freaking children's lives because they're being poisoned with our industrial food complex. And he goes, anything you want, you come on, well, let's get it on. So we've had connections. His kids work out there. They have like 150 employees out there at White Oak Pastures, and it's amazing what they pull off out there. So we're going to have a Beef Initiative Food Intelligence Summit out there in September. And so as I'm pulling off Colorado, we've been planning Georgia. So we'll leapfrog right into Georgia in September. And then I'm in talks with Cole Bolton of KNC Cattle, and we're going to have a kickoff or an end of the year kind of celebration and down in Central Texas, down there south of Austin. And this is going to be, we're going to have a major announcement at that time. And whenever I get back from Colorado, we're going to have a couple more, and I can talk about those tonight. So things have just been busy. We're moving forward. We're plowing ahead pretty hard. And, you know, a lot of people are coming into the understanding, hey, we need to start paying attention to our food. You know, what's happening, you know, in the Netherlands, what's happening in Sri Lanka. People are not understanding, but they know there's issues. And then now with whatever this emergency plan, climate change, you know, what I was talking about last year, it's all starting to kind of play out.
Right. Well, I love everything you just put forth there. And I love the work you've been putting out too, and what you're doing with Texas Slim's Vision. I appreciate how you've been kind of delivering content from early on with your writing and your investigative journalism to now more action plan and more sort of execution at the sort of, I wouldn't want to say consumer level, but at the people level.
Sure.
And, you know, I love traveling. We just did 3 road trips across the country ourselves.
Really?
Awesome. Yeah. And I love getting into the back roads and the different places. I've been taking road trips my whole life. I grew up doing that with my family. But we're now settled. And let's say that I want to get a box of beef.
Sure.
From K&C Cattle. And I also want to make some shout outs to Marty Bent, Parker Lewis, Matt O'Dell. It's important to say these names as well in full, because these people are lending help to this project. And that's some of the Bitcoiners that were mentioned before. But if I'm a consumer, what am I getting? And how does this work? How do I buy the beef and sure. get it? And what am I getting in the box?
Well, right now, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do, because, you know, COVID really stepped up a lot of people buying food online. Right. And so we looked at that. We looked how behavior changed within sourcing, like the staples, like protein and really good vegetables. You know, a lot of people, what they were shipping had changed too. And they got a little bit more bold by shipping food across the United States. And, you know, it was kind of a trial error, but, you know, you had places like Butcher Box popped up and stuff like that about beef and steaks. And so we looked at saying, okay, we can do this, but let's get it, you know, let's kind of start it off in a smaller micro, you know, level. So right now, if you're anywhere in the United States, 48 states of the United States, you can go to thebeefinitiative.com and go straight into beef boxes. And we have like, I don't know, 7 selections. We pop between 7 and 9 right now. I think it comes and goes because of what we're offering, the cuts of the cow, everything like that, you know, inventory control. A lot of people don't understand you got to do that. You know, you have a high demand for ribeyes, but you got low demand for roast. And so you really have to balance out the cow in a certain way.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a bit. Yeah.
Okay. So right now, if you're in the United States and you can order, and everybody that's ordered, I want to say this, thank you so much for ordering from the Beef Initiative. You've actually helped pioneer into a new decentralized way of sourcing and market access of our food. Also, whenever we're buying beef on the internet, what we have to remember, this is not Amazon and it's a low time preference. And so what we've done is we've been monitoring, you know, expectations, perspectives, but I guarantee it hasn't been that bad. And people are really patient and they're really supportive. And we haven't had a lot of issues. We had a shipping snafu, and it was all of course, the shipping lord's, you know, fault. But beyond that, we haven't had a lot of issues. And so confidence is there that anybody in the United States, for the most part, let's not generalize too much, but you can go to the Beef Initiative and you can buy your beef box. We have a premium box. We have, different cuts for everyone, a steak lover's box, a premium box. We have a Texas Slim's top hand beef box. And then, you know, that's the smorgasbord. That's you get your tomahawk and you get 4 other ribeyes. And so it really depends on what type of consumer you are and what you're looking to do with these beef boxes. You can see that where you can, you know, for 2 people, there's a really good setup to where you could eat off that beef box for like a month. And then you look and there's stuff in there for a family of 4, you know, it has a little bit more ground beef in it, but all of them are different varieties and they come with different cuts, like the Denver cut, the Picanha cut, you know, the KC. We throw in a lot of variety that people don't even realize that are out there, and they're actually cheaper cuts. And so that makes our beef boxes a lot more affordable. You know, if you're going to go all New York strip and basically, you know, tenderloins and ribeye, and you can't do you don't do T-bones and stuff like that, because you can't have a T-bone in New York strip. So we're educating with these beef boxes and we're seeing who likes what. So they change every once in a while, but you're usually getting between 16, almost 20 pounds of beef. And right now, I guarantee you, even with shipping, and we've got the shipping now to where we can do 3-day with dry ice, and we're having really good success with that. And the good thing that I can announce tonight, and we've been kind of holding off, is because we're offering 48 states, our volume is about to increase tenfold, we hope. And so we're going to basically go out there and really let everybody know, because we haven't even tried. This has been word of mouth. And, you know, we've gotten to where we were by that. So we're really going to kind of, you know, broadcast out saying, hey, we've got our access to our processing center within the Beef Initiative now. Cole Bolton's about to open his processing center. And that is magical. That is a huge accomplishment, because that's the vertical integration that I've been talking about. And so by saying that, we can do a lot now, and we're going to try to really increase the sales and the awareness so people can really start coming in and really say, hey, we're proof of work. We've been doing this for 7 months now, and we've got most of everything, you know, that we have control over. This is the easiest flow. If you're going to buy beef online, you're going to buy it through the Beef Initiative. I guarantee you.
Right. I think the processing center, I don't think people are getting how big this is. And no, I don't think we've outlined it yet from maybe the rancher's perspective. I know we've touched a little bit about it before, maybe from the macro side, but I want to get into this, like, and this is still, I'm still getting this, but it's like, okay, I guess you harvest the cow.
Yeah.
And so I want to start a little bit in reverse, maybe, because I want to learn about this life of the cow and the value of a cow. So What if we harvest the cow's at its end of its beautiful life, mm-hmm. and what do we get out of the cow? I mean, how many ribeyes can I get out of a whole cow? Let's just stick with like a general cow and just general averages. But I know you don't get all those ribeyes in a box, but what would you get? How much, you know, ground beef, how many ribeyes, mm-hmm. et cetera?
Well, it's a good question. And it is, it's a deep form of innocent, you know, ignorance, because like, how the hell are we supposed to know this? Right. It's like, only thing I've ever done as a person is gone to the supermarket and looked at this beef under, you know, and they have the specials, and they might have a glass, you know, case, and it always says ribeye, and it says tenderloin, and it says New York.
And they're all unlimited, more or less, to me, from a relative perspective.
Right. Like Yeah. So you go through the cuts of the cow, and, you know, there's so much there, from all the way from cheeks to the shank to the oxtail to everything. And, you know, from how they make hamburger is different in a bigger factory farm, you know, harvesting through somebody like JBS than it would be through Coles. Right. And so you talk about ribeyes. Well, there's not that many ribeyes on a cow, you know, and so that's a hard balance. But you get 14, 15 sometimes. It really depends on who the butcher is. It really depends on who the processor is, how they really want to cut that cow out. And one thing that I found fascinating when I met Cole is that he has one of the best butchers that I've ever heard of. He really knows how to butcher a cow. And because a lot of times, even if you're somebody like a small rancher like Cole, okay, you don't have to utilize all those cuts. You can leverage some of those cuts into ground beef, to where you're not going to get that Denver cut. You're not going to get the Picanha cut. You're not going to get the KC. You know, you're not going to get those cuts that nobody knows about. Somebody like Cole can go in there, and with his processor and with his butcher, whatever you want to call him, what he can do is he can educate, to where Cole actually can leverage that education into people understanding this is the true cuts of a cow that you've never known, and you want to try this because it makes your life more affordable when you're eating this beef. Everybody thinks that beef is so expensive because they want to know how many ribeyes are on a cow, instead of saying, how many different cuts can I get out of that cow that I wouldn't get if I was buying it from somebody else? That's the number one question that people probably should be asking. It's like, what are the cuts that you can leverage that's like the ribeye? What are some cuts that you have that are like the tenderloin, and they're out there? You know, you can cut it, you know, like a chuck steak into something different. Most of the time you get a, you know, a chuck roast, and that's what it is. But there's a lot of things you can do with that section of the cow that you can really kind of dissect it down and say, man, this could be a really good steak. And there's restaurants, I can't remember the name of the restaurant in Austin, but they found out about the picanha cut. So they started buying a bunch of picanhas because it was cheaper than what they were doing, the tenderloins. Well, the chef knows how to cook beef, so he's basically helping his business selling that picanha cut, okay? he can still have very satisfied customers, then it can be part of a conversation and that chef can go out there and educate. And that's what he did. So he did that for like a week, two, a month or something like that. Instead of the tenderloins, he was educating the public about this. And so that's what people didn't need to understand is it's so many different varieties that you can go into as far as the cuts of the cow, that's what the Beef Initiative is about to do. We're about to explode right with that type of education. We've been waiting for it to kind of get to a certain level. And like whenever you buy like of a quarter of a cow, we're going to give you that, you know, the cuts of the cow in there. We'll give you the picture of it and you'll be able to see the anatomy. And so you'll kind of know. Right. And then we'll take it even further is like, okay, liver, you know, heart, you know, everybody wants these provincial cuts that basically, you know, are more healthy, more nutrient rich because, you know, it's grass fed, you know, grass finished, all that kind of stuff. People want that. And so we'll start, you know, bringing that in and, you know, saying, hey, if you're in a certain region of the country, you're not going to, you know, as part of the, you know, the Beef Initiative, you're doing this on your own. You can go down and you can find processors that will do those type of cuts. So what it does, it makes everybody go out there and really wants to understand how can I get market access to these type of cuts? And that should be your intention. So, you know, that's how we're looking at it. There's a lot of education to come. And, you know, that's what Cole told me. He goes, I don't sell beef. He goes, 90% of the time, I just educate people about the cuts of the cow.
Right. Do supermarket butchers know what they're doing?
Man, that's a good question. I was in freaking Nashville, okay? And I was like, okay, I'm going to go stack up on some stuff. You know, I'd brought steaks with me and all that, but I'd been on the road for a while. I said, screw it. It's over here because I was staying at an Airbnb that Rod, you know, he gets for Bitcoiners, and it was fantastic. Thank you, Rod. And you go to Nashville, you get Airbnb. So I was like, man, I'm going to go to the grocery store and do the best I can, right? I'm going to go try it out because I usually don't go to grocery stores. So I walk up to the butcher and I had my recorder on and I was recording and I started asking him and I said, hey, because he's got his white coat, they look like the butcher and everything. And I started asking questions. I said, hey, where does this beef come from? You know, it's a general question. And he's like, man, I don't know. It starts with a J. That's what he told me. He said, it starts with a J. He goes, well, sometimes, no, it's not J. I said, is it JBS? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, that's it. That's it. And I said, oh, really? And he goes, well, sometimes it's Tyson too. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, you didn't even cut that steak, did you? You didn't even do much of that that beef that's in that glass window there. And I wasn't being mean. I was really just, you know, asking him questions as a consumer would, or an exchanger of quality and value, as I like to call it. But, you know, so he goes, hell yeah, I cut these. And so he sat back. He goes, you hold on a second. He brought out a plastic bag that had JBS on it, and it was about enough for about four ribeyes. And that's what he cut. He cut those into four steaks, or maybe it was 10 steaks, depending on the price of beef and how much they can squeeze out of you. That's the amount of butchering that his knowledge. He was a really nice guy. I'm not calling him out, but he doesn't know what a butcher knew back in the 70s, 60s, 50s, you know, and everything like that. So it's interesting that you go to these places. It's not that they're not trying to be a butcher. They don't have any way to be a butcher because they get their beef directly shipped to them from the distributor, which the distributor is the processor, and the processor is the bottleneck of the beef industry in the United right. States of America. So we've talked about that.
Right. And their system decides what shape they're going to spit out, mm-hmm. what they're going to emphasize, what's more efficient, what yeah. get left on the floor maybe.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, you know, not the floor, but the scraps. Yeah, definitely the scraps. And they're going to figure out how they can leverage that to get as much money as they can out of that. And it's not based on quality. It's based on yield and subsidized, you know, meat coming in as it's already came in because it's a commodity.
Right. So let's say I'm a rancher and I'm getting through some cycles of cows here. I'm growing up some cows. And I got, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 cows. Can I just show up at one of these major processors and no. when I'm ready to go no. and the cows are ripe?
No, this is a volume. This is a numbers game. You know, you have to be a part of the protocol. Hobby farmers, like what we are, ranchers, but a lot of times they're referred to 10 to 20, you know, on a herd and stuff like that. You're not playing that game. You can play it a little bit. You're not making any money. you know, you're not going to, you're just not going to make, you're, if you're a hobby rancher, you're a lot of times you're doing it just for, you know, just to do it. You know, it's something that you want to be part of your lifestyle, but it's even hard to be a hobby rancher anymore because you just can't go into, you know, JBS and want to get a kill date. That is hard to do. And especially right now, because everybody's culling their herds and people, you know, all across Texas in the Midwest right now, a lot of people are getting rid of their cattle because we're in a drought. And here we go. You know, the inventories are going to go way down. It's going to be amazing here how this plays out. We had something like this in 2011 and 12. I think it's going to be a lot worse. And, you know, everything that's coming together, especially with the war on beef, you know, a lot of people, the reason they can't go and be a hobby farmer or somebody with 10 or 20, because they can't have access to the kill. They can't have access to the processing center, and that distribution that is set up through that processing center has nothing to do with them making money. They drop that cow off. That's it. They're done with that cow. They don't own that meat anymore. JBS owns that meat. JBS owns the distribution. And there you go. I mean, and a lot of people don't even know where it gets distributed, you know, to after it goes into, you know, mm-hmm. one of the four major processors.
So how many touches are between me and the cow? And I don't even know if this goes back to birth. Like, what are these feedlots? And,
well,
you know, where is this kind of, how many stages and touches are there before I get my beef?
Well, it depends.
And I'm talking about the supermarket chain.
Well, this, well, I mean, I'll tell you something I've been talking about, and this comes from ranchers themselves. This is not from Texas Slim. This is from ranchers, and it's called the Brazilian cattle drive. Okay. And I don't know if you and I have talked about that, but I've kind of been hinting it out a bit. And what it is, okay, JBS is a Brazilian corporation, global corporation that's headquartered in Brazil, have massive, you know, corruption, settled out of court many, many times for millions and millions of dollars after the manipulations.
I think we have to note, I mean, bribery here.
Bribery, yeah. I mean,
we have to get into a little bit about what they were doing.
Well, let me tell you about the cattle drive, and then I'll tell you about going back to why this is asinine, that this is happening in the United States. Well, you'll have cattle basically that start off in Brazil, and they'll basically, you know, they're eating grass at that point in time. And I call it the Brazilian cattle drive because it makes its way from, you know, South America, and it'll make its way north into Mexico. And then in Mexico, basically, you'll get, you know, that's whenever you have your fat gain, you know, at the end, that's whenever feedlot ranchers, feedlot, you know, factory farming, as a lot of people call it. And before I go into that, all of the feedlots are not bad places. There's some that are fantastic feedlots. If you don't mind having grain-fed beef, some feedlots have great grains. So let's be very clear about this. This is not a black and white issue. But if in a lot of places, though, and the volume's high, you know, you have a lot of cows being processed out of one major global processing center, it's going to be a little bit different, right? You're going to have a bunch of cows. You're going to have a bunch of, you know, a bunch of money flying around, a bunch of people having touch points to your food. So, you know, you go from Brazil, you go to Mexico. Well, that cow makes it across into the United States. And by that time, you don't know what kind of grain it's had in Mexico. You don't know what kind of shots. You don't know what kind of antibiotics, what kind of steroids. You don't know much about that cow. And then it ends up in a major processing center somewhere down in South Texas. Well, that Brazilian meat is actually what's fed to a lot of people in the United States now. And a lot of the great beef, we still raise the best beef in the world in the United States. A lot of that beef is being shipped overseas to the highest bidder. And that would be China, South Korea, it'll be Japan, it'll be parts of Europe and everything. So we're not even having market access to our good beef. So, and then once that beef is processed, you know, they don't really have to answer to too many things in the United States because they get to stamp that Brazilian cow with USDA. And that's how much our labeling laws are screwed up. And this is just how they play the game. And a lot of these laws are being lobbied and kind of orchestrated by the processing centers themselves. And that's what people don't understand. And let's go back to that corruption. Okay, the corruption of JBS, their owner was thrown in prison for 2 years for bribing the Brazilian president and many politicians. Well, at that same time, there was people being bribed in the United States that nobody ever knew about. Politicians, lobbyists, all that kind of crap. And so this was all done by JBS. And if you do a deep dive into JBS, you can, don't use Google, but you can really do a deep dive into JBS. And you can find out how they've been fined, how they've settled out of court. So I think within the last, since 2016, 17, they've been probably fined, I don't know, $250 million to almost $500 million, you know, for price manipulations and everything. And a lot of times it's not a fine, they settle out of court. The last one that hit them was $56 million, and they settled out of court for that. But that was during COVID, doing price manipulation. And they made $500 million in profit, and they settled out for $56 million. So hell yeah, they're going to do that. And so you look at the type of corruption that's there within our food, within our beef industry. Well, let's talk about the rancher themselves, because they keep on yelling really loud saying, hey guys, do you want all your beef to come from Brazil? And nobody's paying attention to them. And I've known that for years. And that's what it's so hard to do, is to get people to realize, you know, we look at in how they manipulate the marketing of beef, how they, you know, everything they do with beef, you know, it's, there's not a lot of truth in it. It doesn't even matter if you're a great rancher and you try to do the best you can. There's still a lot of corruption that you have to deal with. And that's why it's hard to get out from beneath that JBS, you know, that big four processor umbrella, because where are you going to go to process your cows? Where are you going to find market access? Where are you going to find distribution? Where are you going to be able to handle this? Well, you can't. And that's why we're stuck in this position. So, you know, the original question was how many touch points? Well, you know, that's a lot of touch points for a cow in Brazil to make it to your table in the middle of, like, let's say Austin, Texas.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you kind of have to sell off the cow early.
You do.
To get out, to avoid macro scaling costs you can't deal with, but
exactly.
Probably shucks that the original rancher out of most of the profit margin along the way.
Yeah. And they just survive, you know, they just keep on doing that little fiat cycle over 12 months.
Right. And it kind of, I would think that most of the people along the way on the chain, like to take a feedlot, good or bad, I mean, they're probably incentivized to feed or bulk up this cow as much as possible. They're probably paid by weight.
Oh yeah.
So like you were saying, that's why they do the injections or whatever it is. They don't care about the end result. They just got to beef up this cow.
Yeah.
It reminds me of sort of 2008 with the mortgage industry and, you know, collateralized mortgages and just sort of the transactional nature of, okay, I don't care if this mortgage gets paid back. I get paid for selling it. Even if it gets over reverse, whatever. It reminds me of The Big Short.
Yeah.
And I think with the JBS CEO, wasn't he renting an apartment, or the JBS was renting an apartment in New York City to do all this?
Yeah, it was out in New York City. Yeah. It was just a, you know, just renting an apartment. That's how they established the, you know, the global corporation that they are.
Right. So I remember when I was in Costa Rica, I remember there was a lot of cows everywhere, but they told me even the best cow, the best beef gets sold off to America or somewhere else. It's not served here. I didn't know about that, about U.S. beef. So, you know, if you got to sell out early to kind of even just survive, are new people or young people becoming cattle ranchers?
Well, you see a lot, you know, I kind of scope out Twitter a lot, and there's a lot of livestock, a lot of ranching, a lot of agriculture on Twitter. What you're seeing is the average age of ranchers is about 62, 65, and they're going away. And what had happened is they're kind of the old school guys is saying, this is just how it's always been. And they're right. You know, that they part of that shift that happened in the ranching industry. And they always tell their sons or their daughters saying, you don't want to be a rancher. But I see some movement. I see some people saying, we're going to kind of go back and do it like great granddad did. And that's what I was talking about from the very beginning, is like, we need to look back there and see how they did it. Every bit of it, every bit of the market access, every bit of the community, every bit of the localization, how they did it, the protocol, you know, the regenerative style, everything. And I see a lot of people starting to get very, very excited about it, but it is an educational decade that you have to go through to where you can kind of get any momentum in that direction. I just think with what's going on in the war with beef right now, overall, globally, with how they're kind of engineering it to make, you know, cows be a carbon hazard and all that, you know, this is going to be a tough decade, and it's going to be nasty. And, you know, once again, they're not getting rid of beef. They're taking away market access to the average man in the United States. That's it. You know, people are just going, 78% of the people already across the globe have already said that they're cutting back on their meat consumption. So right. It's happening. It's not like they're getting rid of the cow. They're not. They're making you think it's bad. And they're going to say, well, you need to transition into this fake meat commodity crap that they're, you know, building out.
Right. I mean, I wonder, though, are they also in other ways like increasing or manipulating the price of grains so that ranchers sell their land or switch to grain farming, which just supplies the industrial sludge? I mean, there's so many angles to this.
There is.
And it seems like, I mean, they're trying to crush the decentralization, I think, of farming and agriculture.
100%.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, it seems like more regulation would be called for here, but to your point, you know, maybe that wouldn't have the positive intended effects. Maybe this is the way that things have always been done. I don't want to like take away anyone's livelihoods or, but it seems absurd that, you know, we're with this Brazilian cattle drive where we're importing the beef from Brazil and exporting our beef. It just, that doesn't make sense to me. Do you
go ahead. You talked about regulations, and I just want to clarify real quick, and then we'll go into what you're going to say. We need to understand the reason we're here is because of regulatory capture, and people need to understand what that means. The reason the beef industry is in shambles and going worse, or that it's vulnerable and it's fragile, is because of regulatory capture. And those four processing centers or chemical companies are everybody the ones that have captured it through regulations. You got money, you can go and capture a regulation. I mean, we're in the United States of America. We prove that all the time. So,
right. Do you think there's a war on meat?
Well, you know, that's a bold word, right? I know there's a social and there's a psychological type of engineering that's going on that is against beef, you know, and what that means is that, you know, ever since, you know, cholesterol was bad. Ever since we started getting into fat-free, we got rid of animal fats. We got rid of, you know, anything went into the seed oil, you know, epidemic that we're in right now. You know, you call it what you will. What it is, it's a basically lie based on deception that takes the value away from the cow. So, you know, people say war is a strong word. Yep, it is. It's a strong word. But, you know, tell that to 40% of the farmers and the ranchers that have lost their lands and their families and their livelihoods and legacy. Do you think that they think there's a war on beef? You're damn right they do. And what do they have to say? They can't say anything because the general public doesn't know anything about it because they're always flooding the market. Who's flooding the market? The people that are killing the cow, harvesting the cow, and it controls the distribution. During COVID, you know, there was a lot of culling. A lot of people in the United States had to cull their, you know, their herd. Some of them did. I'm not saying a lot. I don't know the numbers, but there was cows being killed off. There was animals. There was chickens. There was hogs being killed off. At that same time, we were shipping beef in from Canada and South America. And so who took that hit? Well, the American farmer and rancher took that hit, but the general public saw a small hit. And then all of a sudden we had plenty of beef again, but it wasn't American beef. It was shipped into the United States. And that's how we make everybody in the United States complacent, because it's too convenient to go and just go with the flow of their control and their regulatory capture and how they handle the beef industry.
You said about convenience. There seems to be a yearning for convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see there with that?
Well, I reflect, like, you know, how you started the show is like, you know, Grandpa Frank, you know, and Granddad, and what he did, you know. And I look at that really deep, and you look at the mindsets of it back then. He was born in the 1890s, of course, and he passed away in close to 1890. You know, he was over 90 something years old. But saying that, you looked at how he changed, or how he basically survived, right? Okay, somebody in the 1890s. Well, they got a couple of wars there. They had they had the Dust Bowl. He was right in the middle of the Dust Bowl. He had a depression. He had two world wars. He had gold confiscation. He had proxy wars. You had the Korean War, which hit my uncle had to go to and took him off the farm. We had the Vietnam War. We had everything. And well, during those times, he still was able to raise six children. Okay. And he was able to thrive doing it his way, with his grit, with his education, with what he knew. He didn't finish school. He left school when he was 8 years old. But here he is farming and ranching the land, and he knew what he was doing because he was close to the soil. Okay, by saying that, you know, he only got destroyed whenever basically we went off the gold standard. Okay, we go off the gold standard, all of a sudden, he's losing all of his basically ways of basically stewarding his land, raising his family and everything. So by the 1980s, farm's gone, man. He couldn't afford it. We had farm aid. We had all that kind of stuff. It could have stayed in our family, but, you know, he lost the power because they switched into the chemicals, the pesticides, herbicides. They'd already been using fertilizers and everything. So what that did was, you look at my grandpa, Frank, and what he had done, he always looked at food as a form of survival. Okay. And he knew that he looked at that animal. He looked at those chickens. He looked at that hog. He looked at that cow, and he wanted to raise that cow because he knew that would make him powerful, because he's out there 16 hours a day out in the Texas heat doing what he does. And so that was a form of saying, I need enough energy. I need everything. Well, now you look at how we basically have changed in our easy access, our easy distribution. We can go anywhere and get anything. Doesn't mean it's food, though. And so what that's done, that's basically created a yearning for convenience. I don't want to cook tonight. I'm just going to order from Uber Eats. I don't want to cook tonight. I'm going to get a pizza. I don't want to eat today. I'm just going to go to the convenience store. You have way too many options, and they're all engineered and built around convenience. And, you know, on my trip, even in West Texas here, the only kind of innovation you're seeing is you're seeing new convenience stores. Mm-hmm. And so what has happened is that the convenience store has become the new supermarket, and the supermarket is now the convenience store. And so you look at that, well, what's the word there? It's convenience.
Right. And it's primarily tobacco, liquor, and frozen food.
Exactly. You know, a lot of places, small towns, a lot of America is they're food deserts. Small communities now are food deserts. You go into a small town that's got 1,200 people in it, you know what they have? They have a convenience store and a Dollar General. And that's all they have for food. They have to drive 60, 70, 100 miles to go to Walmart. And that's their basically market access to food. And that access to that food is basically just trash. It's a tax write-off or whatever it is at Dollar General. Nobody's making money off of something that came from China that they only pay for a dollar. I mean, come on, man, that's just a trash can. And people don't realize that, but that's all they have to survive on. So once again, it's convenient. You know, there is no stability. There is no survival. Your survival mode is now convenience.
Right. And what I'm getting a lot out of this too is that there's no honor for the rancher in the way the cow is treated. And a lot of that would be given back through profit or just even treating the animal well and getting it to the consumer in the right way. What did you think of those videos? And I don't know where they were from, but maybe Kansas, but you know,
it was Kansas. Yeah.
Yeah. What did you make of that?
Well, it was like, it was funny, all the conspiracy that we had, right?
Yeah.
And why not? You know, that's kind of crazy, but how they framed the shots and how they really did everything, it looked like you had 10,000 cattle that just bellied up, and that's what they did. Well, no, it was four different feed yards. They had dropped those cattle off there because of, you know, insurance. They had to go and do investigations. They had to do whatever they do. And then they had to get ready to destroy them, either utilize what they could or bury them, whatever they do. A lot of times they hide the fact of what they do with those cattle. What happened with those cattle, and this is from the ranchers themselves, they, you know, everybody in the ranching world kind of knows what's going on. It's not always they can talk about it. And so what happened in Kansas during that time, you had this weird weather pattern that kicked in. Okay. Well, these cattle, they're fat cattle. That's what they're called. They're called fat cattle. Their gains are at the peak. But guess what? Whenever you have somebody that's at a peak, all right, I mean, look at the humans, right? If we're, you know, 300 pounds overweight, we're not going to be that healthy, right? And that's just how we are. Yeah. Well, that those type of cattle are raised and they're stewarded in a way to where they're getting a lot of basically of these feeds that we talk about from the grain companies and the chemical companies. And they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. They're fattening up that cattle. Well, you get a cow out there, the cattle have to cool down at night. Okay. And if they don't cool down, they're going to overheat. Whenever you have a fat cow, all those cows that are probably in these, they needed shade. They probably didn't have enough shade. They probably needed some water. But one thing that they were is one step away from death already, because they were so metabolically screwed up on GMO grains. And that's just what it is. It's the ranchers themselves, it's not their fault. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do to make the money they need to survive, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get a weather pattern. Those cows never cooled down. What they did is they kept on heating and heating. And you get a cow that can't like lay on the ground. A lot of people look at cows and they'll be cooling their belly on the ground. That's what they're doing. And so you get a cow that overheats and then it's 100 degrees for 24 hours right around there. And then it keeps on pushing over three digits. They're going to drop dead because they did exactly what they were supposed to do. They dropped dead whenever they got stressed because they're fat cattle.
Right.
And that's it. That's all it is. And everybody goes, oh, it's so many cattle. Well, it's $20 million. But that's a USDA insurance policy.
Do you think someone's seeding that narrative by making those videos go viral?
Sure. Or that's 100%. That's corruption. It's manipulation. It's propaganda, because they play on that, because you're going to get something right now. You're going to look at this situation, especially what Biden just did with his emergency powers with, about climate change. You know, we're on a climate emergency now, man. I guarantee you that's going to be part of the narrative. It works perfectly into everything. Basically what happened was supposed to happen. What happened was a fluke that you had a heat wave. And with that, how they set those videos up in the amount of confusion, once again, that's what, mainstream media does. It causes confusion based on ignorance.
Well, okay. What about I've heard, I see articles in local press about processing plants and different food manufacturers, whatever you want to call them, facilities having fires or different issues. But you do the math and statistically, that's going to happen at some point throughout the years. Is that happening more than average?
Well, you get the status dudes out there that love to be status dudes. And one thing that's going on is, things are weird happening to processing plants. It's just not random, and some of them might just be because, hey, people lost employees during COVID. We squeezed the labor market pretty good there. Give people free money. They're not going to go work and tell them to stay home. They're going to stay home. So processing centers took a hit too. And it's not easy running a processing center. So there could be safety things that have been overlooked. There's a lot of things that could be causing these fires. And, I've had people say, well, this is the same amount of numbers. Well, no, it's not. It's a little bit more than in common. But one thing that is going on that is happening that nobody's fully realizing, and you can look at what's going across the world right now, is that we're going through a major global food industrial shift. Okay. What does that mean? Well, it means the processing centers and basically the big food, we'll call them big food, have been working for a long time to change the food industry. And we're seeing it. That's why you're seeing bugs on TV, and you're seeing Hollywood actors eat bugs on TV. And I called this last year saying they're going to start using marketing and they're going to make you start eating bugs and people are going to eat bugs. But what really that means, if you're having these processing centers and we're reinventing or basically destroying our economy right now with hyperinflation, we're making a new layer of poverty that's going to come out of this. Well, what you do is you take it to the ground and then you rebuild it, right? That's what you do. And so what I see in this is my opinion, but I think it's a pretty good opinion. It's a subjective, but it's based on a lot of things that I know. I see basically this being part of the global industrial shift. That's a squeeze on animal protein, because some of the biggest investors in this new fake commodity, fake meat commodity, be it 3D or stem cell or bugs or pre-proteins, whatever it is, some of the biggest investors in the innovation and the technology behind that have been the four processing centers. And so what they have to do is they have to build new industrial processing centers to process food in a different way. So you can say, well, these are going to be new, safer processing centers. We're innovating. We're going to do it this way. We're going to digitize your food so it'll be that much more safe for you. And that's just a new narrative that they can lean on and leverage to where it will play on ignorance. It'll play on people's basically consumption models because they seek desire, they basically desire and have a yearning for convenience.
And they get to do it on cheap debt.
Of course, 100%. Yeah.
Right.
And everything that gets subsidized within that, you know, that whole industry right now.
Right. As it with the bugs on TV, that made me think of like Fear Factor and Survivor and, you know, a tinfoil hat on. I'm like, how much of that is seeding and grooming? You know, where do you think we are with this sort of COVID marketing plan on kids and this pivot to industrial food sludge? It seems like that in large, broad strokes, I feel like the world is normalizing a bit. In terms of here in the, America, at least, or wherever I've been, like people aren't boiling over yet.
Right.
Do you think there's a major pivot happening here? Do you think things are getting normal?
What I see, and I'll stick to what I know best, and that's the beef industry, and that's the cattle rancher. And that's the type of, you know, that type of culture and that type of business, that type of industry. And what I see right now is that I see there's a big squeeze on beef. And right now across Montana, all the way down to Texas, you got people getting rid of their cattle because we're in a major drought. It's happening. That is happening. And so that plays really into what we've been going through as far as against the prohibition against meat. Let's call it a prohibition against meat, from monetary to intellectually to, you know, nutritionally, there's a prohibition against good meat. So you look at that and you put that together is like, okay, well, you know, if they're really able to seize this moment, then that just benefits them to introduce the type of fake commodities that got going on. And whenever you look at food, what is poverty? I mean, what is your definition of poverty? I'm going to let you know what mine is. What is the reason and cause and the existence that never goes away about poverty?
What is the reason and cause?
Yeah. What is the true reason that poverty really happens?
It's an excellent question. I don't have an answer for you.
Well, I guarantee you, with everything that I've done in my life in the last freaking 3 to 5 years, I used to feed the homeless. I think on that last episode, you know, I told you I used to feed like 250 homeless people. The reason we have poverty in this world is the only one reason. It's because of nutritional starvation. That's it. Because people can never get out of that nutritional starvation from the mind, the body, and the spirit. They're nutritionally starved. And so anytime that a society willfully goes into a nutritional starvation period of time, in which we have done, because we are metabolically bankrupt now, and I can list off every kind of thing that's going on with our health in the United States that a lot of people don't want to talk about. So with this food industrial shift, you damn right people are going to go along with it. They're not even going to be phased because they're going to think it tastes good. And they will, you know, people, I think it was old Eric Snowden the other day. He said something that I've been saying for a long time is that, yeah, I'm not going to eat those bugs. I'm not going to eat those crickets. I'm not going to eat that, you know, and everybody's like being good luck. I'm not going to ever do that, Bill Gates. Well, see, that's the distraction. And that's what people can't figure out. They don't expect you to go cook burgers with that, you know, fake meat or eat that fake steak. They're going to grind that crap up and put it in your pizza pockets and your chicken tendies and everything else that you eat every day. And you're not even going to know what's in there. And they've already got there because they changed all the labeling laws. They've now no more GMO. Now it's bioengineered. Everybody go to the grocery store and go scan it with your phone. You have to scan it before you can get any information. And so it's not about eating a fake steak. It's about eating highly processed food where they're sneaking all this commodity into those food products. And it's going to be across the board, just like canola oil is. And that's what they do. They're good at it because we don't care. We think it tastes good. And there's a video of Bill Gates, and he basically says, yeah, we've got the texture down. We've got this down. It doesn't quite taste just like we know it needs to, but we're going to be there. We're there. And so they know what they're doing. I mean, you look at Royal DSM, they're out of the Netherlands. They made $9 billion in revenue during COVID. You know what they do is they basically learned how to hijack people's taste buds and make something out of chemicals to make you think it's hazelnut, and it's not. And so if they have that power to really manipulate in the lab to make you really think something tastes that good, and they can do it, and it has effects on your neurons and everything up here, well, guess what's being stolen? Nutrition out of your brain. And so they can make anything taste anything like they want, and they can nutritionally starve a society willingly because they think it tastes good, and that's what they're going to do. It's not nefarious. It's business. It's how they do things. They look at yields. You know, maybe it is nefarious now. I don't know, you know, but I don't play that game anymore because I just don't. I walked away from it, and, you know, I knew I had to get a solution for myself and my family, and there's no reason for me to go and buy that type of food anymore because I don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I have tremendous guilt. I remember coming home from work one day, and I saw my two-year-old eating, you know, chicken nuggets from McDonald's, and I was like, all I asked was no fast food, and my wife was like, it's the only thing he'll eat, and they've hijacked his taste buds
from birth now.
From birth,
with the formulas, everything they're yep. going for it, man.
And I noticed when we spoke the first time. I mean, I always knew about this sort of food smell taste industry that was enhancing food. I never thought about it in terms of they were enhancing sludge.
Yeah.
And I've noticed everything I've tried, especially when I try things that like my kids. You know, get, and it reminds me of my youth or something. And I think more closely now about what am I tasting? It hits these notes in my brain, but it's not hitting the notes in my mouth and body anymore that it used to. And it's, there's something very different about it and very synthetic. Any food that comes in a box or
right.
a plastic wrapper is just, it's, and to what I've can't get over is how this is not linear anymore. And I think this is your point. Over the last 10 years, it's 10X. It's now exponential. Mm-hmm. I want to read one of your tweets. Modern day poverty is actually worse from a nutritional standpoint. The amount of garbage handed down to certain communities destroys any chance of functional mental capacity required to rise above. A new layer of poverty has been engineered on a nation. I mean, is this an era of mass prohibition?
Mm-hmm. It's in a way that nobody's ever had to go through before, because you look at that, you know, that thought and that tweet came from, well, let's look at the soup lines during the Great Depression. You can go back and research yourself and look. Yeah, these people were hungry and they were dirty. Maybe, you know, they were starving to, guess what, man, they weren't nutritionally starved. They might have been kind of physically lost some weight and stuff, but in their minds, in their bodies, in their spirits, they were eating eating better in soup lines during the Great Depression than a lot of people today, that homeless people are being fed by community programs, church community programs. And you look at that, better nutrition back then through soup lines than any type of food that you can eat right now that's handed down to a generation to a level of poverty that's never going to get out, because now that they're on that level of poverty, it's almost impossible to get out of it, because not only are they nutritionally starved, they're also diabetic. They're also obese. They're also, you know, blood pressure. There's so many things that goes on that level of poverty. Okay. And I said, we're going to, you know, we're stacking a new level of poverty on the existing level of poverty. Isn't that what we are when we don't have our metabolic health? Do you have any wealth whenever you have to basically shoot yourself up with insulin every day when it costs you $1,000 or $900 a month? Right. I mean, what are you doing? And especially when the medical doctors are, you know, trying to help you with diabetes, but they're not telling you to get rid of carbohydrates.
Right. And it siphons wealth from all the healthy people who are paying jacked up premiums.
100%.
Because the $900 a month is actually just the copay.
Yeah.
And the insurance company is paying 10 grand a month, and that's coming from somewhere.
Well, it's subsidized through the United States government and
right.
pharmaceutical
and
companies
all of us get their and money. Our taxes yeah. And yeah. yada, yada, yada. It's like one big freewheel to siphon wealth by destroying health and using the human as the repository for all this garbage.
Yeah. And you look at those communities, you know, some of those communities that went through on the Texas to Tennessee barn raising tour was what it was, is you had these communities that used to be vibrant. I mean, they used to be a strong ass community, man. They didn't have to worry about food. They ate so well. Now you go to the same community and they're still in agriculture. Some of them are, but you know what? They're the most unhealthy out there. The small farming towns were hit the hardest.
Right.
And they don't know how to get out of it. I was in North Dakota last year in a small town. They had one restaurant, they had a convenience store, and they had a small grocery store, the old time grocery store. Bell peppers were $2.50. Potato was $1.50. Think about that. The beef was not that good and it was way inflated. And most everything else in that super, that grocery store was all in frozen freezers.
Right.
You go to the one restaurant, everything came frozen in a bag. They had fried cheese, fried okra, fried. That was their menu. And so you look at that, and that's a small community that used to have farmers markets. They used to have very good, proud people that came to the community and said, we're going to feed each other and we're going to trust each other. And those days are gone, and they're captured in a way that nobody wants to talk about, because a lot of people don't remember those times. And even if you're in agriculture, you don't really want to talk about it, I guess, because I have cousins, right? All right, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cousins at my age, and bless their hearts, I love them to death. They're all metabolically screwed right now, from diabetes to heart disease to obesity to high blood pressure. I grew up eating the same thing that Grandpa Frank and they did. What they did is they went in a different route of their consumption model than I did. And it shouldn't be that way. These farming people, but that's how bad it's captured in my mind. And that is the poverty, not only just our health, but this inflation, hyperinflation, how they're pricing people out of beef, and people are going to start eating, you know, fake meat or whatever. They're going to eat macaroni and cheese is what they're going to eat, which is just sugar in a damn cup. And people don't realize that. And so, you know, that's the poverty that we're going to get, because people that used to eat beef are now going to be eating macaroni and cheese in certain, you know, parts of this country, because it's already happening.
It's not even cheese.
No, it's not. It's chemicals. It's just chemicals.
Yeah.
And that's it is. I mean, it really, it's chemicals.
And it's probably like kicking off dopamine.
Of course it is.
You know, like the way a Dorito does or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, the, you know, just going back and designing all these tastes, you know?
Right. And then so now, though, your body, your mind's going to desire this taste that doesn't actually represent anything nutritionally good for you, but you like it. You know, you're used to it.
Tastes,
you know,
good,
it's
man.
Kicking off the bells. I don't even know. Like, I don't think it tastes good if you've tasted the real thing or grew up the real thing.
It doesn't.
But if you've never had the real thing,
how would
I
you
didn't
know?
Grow up. I mean, I don't drink a lot of soda, but even when I was growing up, we never had regular soda in the house. My mom always drank diet soda, and I thought it tasted fine.
Right.
Until I went off to college and no one drank diet soda. And I got used to only drinking what was around a little bit. And I was like, wow, this is better. And I moved on. But like, I was thinking that saccharin and all that stuff was tasty. And now that stuff makes me like ill. Like I'm repulsed by any foods, drinks that have any of those sweeteners in it. It's just, you know, but I could see if I stuck with it, maybe that would be what I have a taste for.
Well, I mean, you think about somebody that drinks, you know, Diet Coke used to is like, well, my grandmother got caught in that trap too. And later in age, she drank Diet Dr. Pepper. It was in a blue bottle, right, believe it or not. And so she pounded that stuff because she thought it was going to help her lose weight.
Right. It actually makes you hungry.
Yeah,
exactly. In odd ways. And so it doesn't have any calories, but it's got a lot of fake shit in it and salt and makes you hungry. And
yeah.
Right. Your body's looking for food.
Right.
What do you see that people don't want to talk about in the U.S. when it comes to health?
I mean, you can't say anything about it anymore. And people think it's a judgment. And where I come from, my perspective is like, I'm not judging you, man. I'm really trying to help you understand. I want you to understand why this is happening, because this is a short period of time in human history that this has happened. This is since 1971 until 2022. You can look at it, man. The numbers are there. Once again, going back to the people who like stats, look at it. It's a no-brainer, and it's nobody's fault. And nobody decided to be gluttonous. you know, most of us are very well-intentional people. We want to do the right thing. We want to trust, and we want to have a good time in this life. And that type of yearning, as I say, though, for convenience, has been leveraged against us in ways that people don't understand. It's as simple as that. And why are you going to actually say anything, or why is somebody going to have discussions with you, especially when you're going to a doctor and they're not even really helping you with the diet and nutrition? Because every doctor that's come into the Beef Initiative, you know, that's participating with us, they don't get any education on nutrition. They're a different type of doctor. So they don't know how to advise. And then the nutritionists, and people are going to get pissed off at me about this, but a lot of nutritionists, their education came from, guess what? Somebody that's part of the global food industry. You know, you go into a medical clinic. I was in a medical clinic the other day. Well, it's a couple of weeks ago, actually, before I went, 2 months, time flies. But I went in there and I was talking to some people, and I went into the restrooms, and everything about food, diabetes, and everything said nothing about getting rid of highly processed foods, getting rid of sugar, you know, the things that you need to do to get off diabetes. And this is how they're advising their patients.
Oh my goodness. I just spent a month in a hospital watching my dad, watching them kill my dad.
Right.
You said on one of our earlier shows, it's big business to kill people. Mm-hmm. I honestly think they sold him a surgery he wasn't a good candidate for. And everything that happened from there, just systemically, I'm not saying that people weren't trying their hardest or, you know, but
sure,
it's an industry and it's siloed by design and has the wrong incentives. I lost my train of thought there for a second.
But going back into that, as far as, you know, what we're talking about, people's self-image is what we're talking about. And people don't want to talk about it. You know, they don't want to admit that they're vulnerable, that they're maybe they're sad. Maybe they've got a lot of anxiety. Maybe they've tried, but they haven't got the right advice and maybe the right consultation. You know, the way to look at your food and the way to look at losing that food, you know, that weight or getting healthy, right. You're being advised wrong. And that's the hardest thing that I'm seeing.
Yep. So my father woke up from the surgery, mm-hmm. and I go to visit him, and he's got a Caesar salad. He's 80 years old. He's a diabetic. He should only be on a liquid diet. It's right. Post-surgery. I mean, he's a diabetic. He shouldn't have a Caesar salad. At this point in time, his intestine had collapsed. They didn't know it. But none of this made any sense. Yeah. And that was just like one small point. It's like, what are we feeding this? Like, even just small little things. Like, what are you feeding him?
Yeah. You know. I've seen a lot of those tweets where it said, hey, you know, this is what they served my wife while she was recovering. And, you know, it's the stupid, you know, the worst food. And you're like, really?
Yeah.
You know, and you would think that they would make the attempt to do something about that, but they're not, because it's a controlled consumption model. It's a controlled market access that is so big now that, you know, like I say, I mean, I went and worked with churches, and what they do is they get food donated from them from distribution centers. And you look at that food and it's just compounded after compounded, a fake commodity after fake commodity.
Right. And it's a write off for the business who overproduced food or yeah. for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just more siphoning of wealth, more destruction of capital.
Yeah.
So what can we learn from the cowboy way? Well, what would Grandpa Frank say about all this?
Well, and that's the thing about it. He always just shook his head. I mean, he thought the world was going to a hand in the handbags, you know, back ever since I was a little kid, which is, you see that in generations, of course, especially guys that, you know, that live the way he did. And what people need to understand is this is so simple, it's complicated to people. And people ask me all the time, they say, what is the Beef Initiative? And it's a lot of things. It's what you make it. But one thing it is, it's about building relationships. And what we have to understand is we have to build strong relationships with those people who basically give their lives, everything they do in this life, to basically grow food for you, because that's who they are. They follow their heart. They're close to the damn soil. They know what they're doing. And they know why they're doing it. It's not some random yield that they're trying to hit. It's not some random, you know, profit margin they're trying to hit. They're doing it because they have to. That's they know that much about themselves. So by saying that, you know, go develop some relationships, you know, and I'm the first one to say, I know that not everybody can do what, you know, Slim does is go out there and meet all these ranchers, because that's just not possible. So let's look on the flip side of that. Okay. You're somebody in a city, let's say you're up in, you know, in New York City. It is going to be difficult. I agree with you, but you can still go build some relationships with some people in that city. I've been in New York almost 20 times. I know I could go there right now and find market access to pure animal protein. I know I could do that. And that's what people aren't doing, because they have a complacency that's built off a yearning for convenience. And so saying that New York City, well, let's say somebody like you're in Nashville, Tennessee. Let's say somebody like you're one of the people over there at Bitcoin Park. Well, they said, hey, Slim, how do we do this? And I say, okay, we're going to come back in a couple of months. I'm going to come back to Nashville. What you're going to do right now is you're going to go out there. And this is for anybody, but let's focus on the Bitcoiners. I had a conversation with them recently, all of them. And I said, what you need to start doing is look outside of Nashville, find somebody that's in the regenerative mindset, regenerative farming and ranching, a regenerative producer that you like. And you don't even know why you like them yet, because you're going to have to go out there and meet them. Establish a relationship, go up to them and say, hey, I want you to educate me. I want you to tell me why you do what you do. I want to know more about who you are and where you come from. And if you come across somebody like Jason Rick or Cole Bolton or Justin Trammell, all these ranchers that have come in, they're going to start talking to you and they're going to be, wow, man, somebody really cares. And then you're going to ask him, if we're a Bitcoiner, we're going to say, man, we have this meetup once a month that I want you to come to, and I want you to come educate us about food. I want you to educate us about the cow. And you get that person, that rancher, that man or that woman, that rancher to your Bitcoin meetup, and he starts talking, you just basically develop market access for your food. And we've got Bitcoin meetups all across the United States in every city. In every city, that's what they should be doing right now. And I've found that out all these years. That's the best way to approach this. And so if you are somebody out there that are wanting to cause change, I can't tell you how many people are contacting me in DMs from Chicago to Boston to Maryland to Wyoming to Idaho to Oklahoma to Missouri to Arkansas to Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, and they're doing it. And they're going out there and they're meeting people and they're getting at least a conversation going, and they're at least establishing a relationship. Is that all of those ranchers and all those producers, are they orange pilled? Not yet, because that's not something you do to them. That's rude. What you do is you decide, you develop a relationship with them. You establish some trust and some respect, and then you let them educate you. And then you go and you purchase what they're selling, what they're offering to you. Once that conversation evolves to a certain level, you know where the conversation ends up? It ends up in the Bitcoin. And so that's what people don't understand. We need to turn it around. Let them educate us first, and then we'll come along and then we'll educate them when they're ready. They're not ready yet. You know how many times they get manipulated and corrupted every day? Somebody trying to sell them a bullshit website. Somebody saying, I'm going to make you online and we're going to sell all your stuff online. Happens every day. You think they haven't been, you know, lied to 1,000 times. And so don't be a salesman. Go in there and say, I want to know more about you. I come with some truths. I come with some transparency. And why do you want to know this? Well, because I really want to learn how to eat better. I want to know more about nutrition that comes from the soil. I'm tired of eating, you know, from these supermarkets, from these convenience stores. And then this is exactly what you do. You build soil and you build an animal that is basically the best form of protein in the world. And I want to know more about it. And once you do that, you're doing something. You're intentional. You're basically creating a consumer demand that rancher deserves. And if you create that, you, the individual, create that consumer demand from that supermarket to that rancher, things change, and they change fast. Cole Bolton, he's doing fantastic down in Austin. Jason Rick, he has got so many customers right now, he doesn't know what to do with them. We're having the conference there. He's going to be sold out every year. He's going to get a bigger herd. Todd Wheel of Wheel Ranches in Arkansas. I haven't talked much about Todd, but he was about to fold and give up and he came to Kerrville. Now he's buying a bigger herd. He's already sold out. Bitcoiners are, and all he has is his phone number on the beef initiative. And that's it. That's it. That's what changed his life. And he drove all the way from Arkansas to Kerrville to tell me that. So, you know, these people are out there. They want us. They want to educate us. We have to allow that education. It's not Amazon, man. This is not Butcher Box. This is not Whole Foods. This is real life. This is about survival. This is about maybe engineering your own suffering so that suffering is not engineered upon you. Start with food because your life improves. And nobody can argue that. You go out there and you establish a relationship that wants somebody that wants to feed you, your life is going to get better. It's without a doubt. And it's so simple, it's complicated. And so, okay, let's say that's the person that can go out there and create that market access for themselves in their local community. Well, what if you can't? Well, then that's when you come through the Beef Initiative. And that's how we help people out. I mean, I'm talking from people in Australia now, France, UK, you know, across the United States and across Canada, South America. People are saying, how can we do this in our local communities? And so that's what we're working on. That's where we're moving in 2023. This is, you do it. You basically, Rod there at Bitcoin Park, he's like, you know, you apply it locally, you engineer it locally, but you broadcast it globally. And it's so true right now. You have success where you're standing. And then once you have that success, you let everybody know about it. And they kind of take that from you. And they say, well, this is where I am in Australia. And I'm looking at Australia right now. And I've got some, that's probably the most connections I have, man. They have a lot of the same processing centers and the same setups that we have. They have the microprocessors, they have the big global ones. I have a producer in Australia that's already changed the way they process their beef in Australia. They found a different processing. Now they have more say. Because now they can become and start creating a market access because they're not relying on that bottleneck from that processing center. So you look at your communities in a lot of places in Europe, they don't have a bottleneck as bad, but they need to understand that what's going on in food intelligence. So every, you know, continent's different, every country's different. And so that's what we're looking at within the Beef Initiative is really starting to broadcast this, you know, more in a global stance. And when we go to White Oak Pastures, you know, that's going to be the Beef Initiative Food Intelligence Summit. And, you know, that's going to be something that basically we're going to have 100 people that get to come to that conference. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to live stream that globally. Mm-hmm. And we're going to make sure everybody across the world knows what's going on when that live stream happens. That's going to be exciting. And people are going to start understanding because anybody listening right now, go to White Oak Pastures, find it. Go to it, research Real Harris, his family, everything he's done the last 25 years. You look at what we're doing this weekend in Colorado, that's exactly what Jason Rick is doing now. So we have the now, and then we have the last 25 years. We have proof of work. We have a span of over two decades, two guys doing the same thing, different parts of the country, and they're both having great successes because they're doing this vertical integration back from into the soil all the way to your fork in vertical integration back into human health. That's what this is about. And, you know, at the end of the year, whenever we go down to Texas and we get to celebrate what we did in 2022, we are going to basically kick off the Great American Health Initiative. And it's going to be led by the Great American Rancher. And we're going to make sure everybody knows that because we're going to punch back just as hard as they're punching us. And if we get everybody involved with this, we change that consumer demand to your local guy that want, or woman, gal, you get them. Basically, guess what? This is going to pick up a lot of steam, and people, once they know that we're not buying their food, they're probably not even going to pay attention to us. That's the thing about this. You know, you look at percentages, but that's okay. The people that want to have a better life within their food consumption can have it. And it's right out there for the taking right now. That's it. What are you going to not work, watch Netflix on a Saturday? You know, don't watch Netflix on a Saturday and go shake a hand. And I get pretty bold with that these days because I saw the complacency out there. I saw grown men out there that are unhealthy and they're too lazy to go out there and do something about it. And they, some of them, it's innocent. They don't know how. I saw a lot of guys that don't have father figures. Saw a lot of guys that don't have mentors. And so that's what I'm trying to be all in one. And you get into the Beef Initiative, you start meeting people that are wanting to mentor. They're wanting to advise. They're wanting to help people out. That's why this is so rewarding right now.
Yeah, I love what you're doing. I really like this quality for value. And rephrasing it in value for value. I like calling it quality for value. I think even with, I love how you're taking this, you're decentralizing things, but bringing it globally.
Yeah.
So it's like double impactful. And what I really love, well, one of the things I think about with just the beef initiative is that it also tastes better. So
it's a no-brainer, man.
And I think it kind of like, you can make all the other valid arguments that we've made, but at some point too, you're like, it's worth more to me. I'm not saying it costs more, but it's worth more.
Yeah.
Because it tastes better. And you start to say, I want the better thing. Now you're always dropping things that kind of stick with me till our next talk. On our last show, you mentioned, because it seems like everything we've talked about over these three shows, there's a silent genocide happening. Mm-hmm. It seems like, and what really stuck with me though, beyond that from the second show, was that how there's this modern day, this do-goodism, which is sort of modern day feudalism.
Yeah.
And it's sort of people enslaving or caging themselves. And I think about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps me think through like either the current thing, right, or what's going on, how to just understand what my benefit might be. And, to support myself,
right,
and be proactive. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. In terms of quality for value, and I love what you're doing with the podcasting and podcasting 2.0.
Yeah.
In terms of quality of value, I don't know if you'll be at BitBlock Boom at the end of August.
I'm not going to. We got too much going on.
A lot going on.
Yeah,
I'll be there. I'll be searching for the best brisket.
Right.
That's what I'll be doing.
Are you going to go to Beefsteak? I'm
gonna go to Beefsteak.
Well, I think there's something. I think Cole down there, I don't know if he's, something's going on. I don't know. People are looking for beef down in Austin, that's for sure. So, but
I'll be on the hunt.
Yeah, I'm doing so much that it's just, I can't get there this year. So, and that's fine, because we've got the conference right after that in Georgia. So,
because when I was going back and forth three times through the country, one of the things I enjoyed immensely was Southern barbecue.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. We went, one of the places we went to was Smoky Mountains.
And where'd you go? Where were you? Because I was just there. Do you remember?
We were at some.
Because there's a lot of little. Yeah, I stopped through there and it's just beautiful anyway.
It is beautiful.
We won't get sidetracked.
What's crazy about it, I mean, it's a little, to me, overdeveloped in terms of it's like Disneyland, very touristy. Mallification.
Yeah.
And that's what people want. But that makes me a little sad that you're in this. You could build that anywhere. It doesn't have to be on a mountain. And then you go down the other side of the mountain down into like North Carolina and Georgia. And it's beautiful. But it's like you were saying, a lot of poverty.
Yeah.
And it's depressed because they don't have that tourist mousetrap. And that's what people are looking for. And the other things in that area just not as valued. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy what they did in even Georgia with the dams and how they affected agriculture there. And but really, it's just great going to see America and going to the different towns, especially the small ones off the beaten path. The best barbecue we ever had was in Chattanooga.
Where'd you go? I was there as well.
We just stopped off the highway at this place.
Just found something,
and it was amazing. I dream every day pretty much of going back.
Wait till
I could find it.
Well, there's no better barbecue than Texas barbecue. So just take that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm right. When you're down there, you can go to all kinds of different places. You just ask me, and I'll tell you where to go.
I'm starting to learn the differences because there are regional differences. Do you have a favorite barbecue sauce? I've fallen in love with the Carolina Gold.
Well, the Carolinas have a different type of sauce. I mean, all the way from, that's the thing about it. Okay, barbecue in Tennessee, right? Okay, that's going to be more based on hog, right? So in Texas, your barbecue is going to be based on beef, you know, briskets and all that kind of stuff. So you understand the regions is like, what's the livestock and everything? And brisket's done different in Tennessee than it is in Texas. Sauce is different in South Carolina than it is in basically North Carolina, really. South Carolina, though, if you're going to have barbecue sauce, I love South Carolina's sauce. It's different. It's got, you know, it's a different twang to it.
Yeah.
I don't like sweet barbecue sauce. I'm not a sweet guy. So when it comes to that, but you know, I like that. If you're going to have that type of sauce in that region of the country, South Carolina is my favorite. And there's a lot of good people. We had some good meetups in South Carolina as well.
Yeah. I love barbecue. I'm a novice. So yeah, I'm taking it all in. Slim, this has been so dope. It's always great catching up.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I mean, really going back, I mean, I was on Princey not too long ago, and you know, you guys really kind of jumped on this pretty early. And I really need to, because I try to tell everybody as much as I can, you know, thank you, because especially you guys have been around, you were established, and you really helped people hear what I was saying. And thank you for that, because it's people are listening. And so, you know, a lot of respect for you. You do everything right as far as podcasting, how you really clip things, you build that intrigue. That's about execution, you know, and that's what's needed these days, is that quality exchange of value. And that's what we all need to see. I did a little rip the other day. I said, I'm a horrible consumer, but I'm a damn good exchanger of quality of value. And people need to start looking at everything they do in life. And that happened to me driving down the road after I got back from, you know, the South. And it's like, man, I'm a shitty consumer. I've never been a good consumer. I don't like it. I'm not good, man. I go into Walmart, I spend $20. I feel guilty, because I was taught, if you want something, my grandpa Frank, just like we were talking about, he said, if you want something really bad, you wait 3 days. And if you still want it after 3 days, you want it. And that's okay, because you did that patience. You did that, is delayed gratification is what it was back then. Now it's low time preference. And so, you know, that's how I look at things. And, you know, that was never hard for me. So I've never been a materialistic guy, and I never liked, you know, shit coin food. And I was lucky, because I didn't have to have those engineered tastes into my taste buds. And like you said before, you know, good beef when you eat good beef, and you know, once you have it, you don't ever want to ever have anything again. It is that much of a difference. And so people need to understand that.
Well, I really appreciate your kind words. This is a passion project, a labor of love. I do it in my free time. I sacrifice a lot to mostly around not getting to see my wife and kids when I put in time in this. And
yeah,
because I do it outside of my, what I now call my day career. It's not a job. I have a long time right. career.
Right.
And I have to manage that during the day. And so I get pulled in a lot of different directions. I do really appreciate the kind words, and I always enjoy our conversations. I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find, you know, sure. You and your work.
Well, the best way right now, I steer people basically to the Beef Initiative. You can find out so much on thebeefinitiative.com. You look at our conferences, you can look at, you know, the tour I just did, you can buy beef boxes, everything that you need to know. And then of course my Substack, that how we got here, is texasslim.substack.com. It's that simple, texasslim.substack.com. But what we did today is we just announced on Twitter, and we've got a new handle, and it's at TX Slim Media, at TX Slim Media. And it's going to be our media channel that we're creating. I know, since the ranchers basically out there have no media voice, well, we have to be the media channel for the beef industry, and that's what we're about to kick off. I'm doing an audio docu-series now. We're going to have one episode at least every week to 10 days. They'll be almost about, I don't know, 40 minutes to 60 minutes long, and they're going to be high production value, and it's going to be about the state of affairs. It's going to be about talking to the ranchers. It's going to be about the word and basically the boots on the ground, what's really going on in this. And with our food and everything. So it'll be a, you know, kind of a up-to-date live stream of real happenings. And so I think that will have a lot of success for people wanting to tune in to kind of know what's going on. So of course I'm at Modern Tea Man and on Twitter, but those are the best. And we have, of course, at Beef Initiative. But, you know, that new media channel, the conferences that we're coming up with, Colorado, like you said, this will probably record after that, you know, we'll let you know how that happened. We're going to have audio, video, and we're going to slice that up and provide it to everybody so they can see it. since this is going to air afterwards. And then we're going to do the same in Georgia. You know, it's going to be the Beef Initiative, basically Food Intelligence Summit. And it's going to be a summit of a lot of great minds and people that are really making change right now in the food industry. The timing couldn't be better. And then as far as anything else, you know, get ready, because we're going to start selling a lot of beef. You need to buy beef in the United States right now. You want a beef box, you go through the Beef Initiative. We will get you. We have the capacity. We have the volume. We have the processing center. We have the distribution. We have everything lined up, and with proof of work, we've been doing it for 7 months, and we're doing it in fiat, and we're doing it in Bitcoin. And we've had some great partnerships with Ibex now, with Oshi, with we're working with Voltage, we're working with Foundation, we're working with a lot of people in the Bitcoin community. We've built a technology stack that we're going to give over to the ranchers and that we're going to utilize to be able to sell beef in Bitcoin. So
awesome, bro. This is so dope. Thank you so much, Slim.
Thank you so much, Cedric. Appreciate you. Talk to you soon.
This episode with my great friend Texas Slim was brought to you by CipherSafe. Protect your Bitcoin from disaster, bad dogs, and a single point of failure at CipherSafe.io. And don't forget to use the code MATRIX for 10% off your order. Stack sats, stay humble, and thank you for listening. This is Cedric. Peace.